The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Daryl Schweitzer. I will be the interviewer tonight. Tonight we are here to talk about The Winds of Dune, and our guests are Brian Herbert and Kevin Anderson. And to introduce who they are, Brian Herbert is the son of Frank Herbert. He is the author of numerous books. I jotted down a short list here. That is, numerous books that don't have anything to do with Dune. He had quite a career on his own. Sydney's Comet, 1983. The Garbage Chronicles, 1985. Sudana, 1985. Man of Two Worlds with his father as a collaboration, 1986. Prisoners of Arion, 1987. Race for God, 1990. And then numerous Dune books we will talk about. He also edited the notebooks of Frank Herbert's Dune in 1988. Kevin Anderson published his first story in 1982 in Space and Time magazine. Is the author of Resurrection Incorporated, the Game Earth trilogy, Lifeline, The Trinity Paradox, The Saga of the Seven Suns, which I believe ran seven volumes. It's a long, sprawling space opera series. So he is indeed eminently qualified to collaborate with Brian Herbert on the further extensions of the Dune series, of which The Winds of Dune is the latest volume. And so without further ado, I'll bring them out. Hey, guys. Without further ado, I'll bring them out. This is Brian Herbert, and this is Kevin Anderson.
But you've already introduced us.
I already did, yes. No,
all right.
I even brought the cheat sheets.
We were told the clapping would be our cue.
I couldn't remember how many volumes of the Saga of the Seven Suns there are, but never mind. I think there's one for each.
I kind of cued that into the... Yes.
I was actually born in the previous century. I'm going to turn this thing on.
Yes. Well, speaking of the previous century, we got to our nice hotel room and it checked in. It's this nice hotel, and it's got the TV sitting there, and there's a VHS player hooked up to it. And I looked at it, and I thought, was I supposed to bring my own tapes or what?
Oh. Well, they just took the beta player out.
Maybe it was this grand old hotel with antiques, and so the VHS player was there. I don't know.
Hey,
you're interviewing us, so I won't
keep... interviewing you, yes. I've heard that. So... Well, we're here to talk also about the latest book, Winds of Dune, which you will find copies for sale upstairs. And it is the... How many volume in this?
It's the 11th, and it's actually our 11th. Second sequel to Frank Herbert's Dune and Dune Messiah.
Okay. Yes, otherwise we'd have to count. Yes, there are a lot of them. All right. First off, we'll start with Brian. Well, I checked the chronology... And as you were born in 1947, I figure that you would have been about 16 when the Dune started to serialize an analog, and presumably about 14 or 15 when your father was writing it. So, did you grow up with Dune? Did he take, you know, did he say, here, look at this and show you new chapters?
Yeah, I was about, Paul Atreides was 15 at the beginning of Dune, but that's about the only comparison with me. I did grow up with it. My dad would read chapters to my mother, and my mother had been a creative writer, and she'd given up her writing career to support our family. So she gave him professional advice. She was his intellectual equal.
Okay, but
that's the short version of that answer. But I can go a lot longer.
You could.
Well, actually, my mom got terminal lung cancer when I was in my 20s, and prior to that, I didn't think I liked my father at all. But Dad went into another gear. He became her maid, her cook, her nurse. He built an incredible house for her at Hana on the island of Maui, where she could breathe easier with lung cancer. And she was a miracle survivor. Instead of 6 months, she lived for 10 more years. Dad and I became absolute best friends on the planet. So from a really rocky beginning with my father, uh, I, I'm really pleased that at least we had the time to get very close.
Well, let me add something, because he's not going to gush about his own stuff so much, but he Brian spent years writing this wonderful biography called Dreamer of Dune, and he went through this whole span of Frank Herbert's life, and it's really a story about Brian growing up in the household with this incredible dynamo of a guy. And he sent me a copy of the manuscript when he had finished writing it, and because he's my friend, I've got to read it and tell him it's a great book, but I'm not really a big biography guy, and I like things with a plot, and people's lives don't usually follow the standard story structure. But I read this biography that he wrote, and it's just incredibly captivating. It's the best biography that I've ever read, and it was nominated for the Hugo the year it came out. And for any of you who are Dune fans, and I'm assuming there's a couple of you in the audience because it's a Dune presentation, you really will understand a lot more, not just about Frank Herbert, but about Brian, too. And it's a really excellent book.
Thank you. It's a love story between my parents, too, and what they sacrifice for each other.
But what I'm basically thinking of is were you led to be a science fiction writer simply by either having it in your genes or having it in the air?
My wife noticed that I was writing really good letters. I'd write complaint letters, and I would defeat attorneys for big corporations and get rebates on products and small-size settlements and things. So she said, why don't you go to your father, and he'll help you with your writing. You are basically a good writer, she said, but he can help you put stories together. And just about that time, he and I were getting close. So I'm only writing because my wife encouraged me to do it.
At what point did you decide to extend the Dune series?
Well, when Dad died in 1986, he'd been writing. He'd just been beginning Dune 7. And I saw him use a yellow highlighter on Heretics of Dune and Chapter House Dune, but I didn't know there were any notes. And my mom died while that book was being written, and she titled the book. That is her title, Chapter House Dune. And there's a 3-page tribute to her at the end of the book. And I felt emotionally, since they were a writing team, that that's where the series should end. But I knew on the other side of my brain, the logical side, that there were more stories to be told. And Dad had tried to publish mystery stories in the 1950s and 60s, and they were all rejected. But he left his series on this huge cliffhanger, this mystery. And it was up to Kevin to convince me. I mean, other writers had approached me, you know, well-known writers. And I turned them all down because I do manage my dad's business, the estate, and I just felt it should end. But Kevin convinced me otherwise, and I'm glad he did. I mean, he and I have had like a 10-minute argument in 11 years, and one of us apologized, and then we went on from there.
I can be persistent sometimes.
So Kevin, where did you actually enter into all of this? How did you become the collaborator of Dune?
Well, let me back up a little bit, because I was a Dune fan since I was about 11 years old is when I first read the original Dune. And I loved it. It was this big adventure story on a science fiction planet, this young hero banding with desert rebels against the big empire and riding giant sandworms. And it was this great story. And then I read it again when I was in college and got all these other layers into this book. I didn't notice them at all the first time I read it, the politics, the economics, the religion, and all kinds of interesting deep layers that's in Dune. And I just fell in love with it, and then I started reading all of Frank Herbert's other books, not just all of his Dune books, but his Hellstrom's Hive and Dossati Experiment and The White Plague and The Eyes of Heisenberg and everything. And I really studied how Frank Herbert wrote because I loved what he did so much. And I learned vicariously how to be a writer from the way Frank Herbert did it, because I didn't think anybody could do better than Dune. And I wrote stories and published them in small presses. I sent them to various places. Daryl Schweitzer rejected a bunch of them. Yes, he really did. And then I got some novels published. When I sold my very first novel, I decided that I wanted to send the very first copy of my very first published novel to Frank Herbert. And by selling the book to Signet Books, I was able to get the Science Fiction Writers of America membership directory. So I had Frank's home address. And I had planned on doing this to thank him for everything that he did. But between the time that the book was accepted and before it could be published, Frank Herbert passed away. So I never I never managed to get in touch with him. I never managed to meet him. But I went on to have a relatively successful career of writing my own fiction. I was nominated for a bunch of awards, and then I started working for Lucasfilm and the X-Files. And finally, I got to the point where Brian was doing, with Ed Kramer, the man who runs Dragon Con, he was going to do an anthology of Dune short stories. And I was one of the people invited to do it. But as a Dune fan, I just wanted to know how the Dune saga ended. After Chapter House Dune, Frank Herbert just left this cliffhanger. And when this idea came up, I just thought, well, all he can do is say no. It's a shot in the dark. And I wrote a letter pretty much describing how much my interest was in Frank Herbert, my passion for the Dune universe and for all of Frank Herbert's stuff. And I just asked if Brian was ever going to finish the series himself, or if he had any plans to work with somebody else, or if he'd be willing to work with me. And he kind of sat on my letter for a month or so, and then he called me out of the blue. Now, as Daryl can tell you, most science fiction people, we all know each other anyway. I know most of the writers. We know most of the big fans. But I had never met Brian, so he was an enigma to me. He was the son of my literary hero. And he called me up out of the blue, and we just started talking. And like I said, I've read everything Frank Herbert wrote. Brian's read everything Frank Herbert wrote. And within like 3 minutes, my wife was in the room. She said, "You guys just started speaking a different language." We were riffing off of each other and talking about nuances in Whipping Star or The Heaven Makers or obscure Frank Herbert books, and finishing each other's sentences. And we just, it just really clicked right away. And
sort of like a jazz performance.
Yeah, it's like a jazz performance. We just were going from there, and then I flew up to Seattle to spend some time with him. My wife and I went up, and we brainstormed, and we were off and running. We had climbed up on the wild Chehalud, and we were riding off.
I did try to dig up some dirt on Kevin before I called him, and I couldn't find any. And just the other day, I met Bob Salvador for the first time, and Bob said I should have called him. Yeah.
I spread around bigger bribes than Brian was putting
around, so. Well, Brian, I noticed the first several books you published, possibly as many as five or six, have nothing whatsoever to do with the Dune.
Well, actually they do.
All of them?
Well, Sidney's Comet. Sidney's Comet, my first novel, was my third book. The first two were humor books, but that is about a world that is too much consumerism, and there's no room for garbage. There's actually no room for bodies or anything to be buried. So everything is catapulted into deep space as garbage littering the cosmos, but it's all coming back as a garbage comet and to wipe out the planet. So that's an environmental, you know, theme, albeit kind of funny. And Futurama, I guess, did something on that, and I didn't know about it, in time to take any legal action, but I think it was a satire. I think they did a half-hour cartoon show on Saturday morning on it. Yeah.
I can also remember a television show called Quark, which was about galactic garbage collectors.
Right.
So there is a garbage mythos in science fiction, but
right.
If we think back to the Garbage World by Charles Platt, but maybe we don't need to.
Well, and my Time Web series also is on the same theme. An environmental theme, but I made it bigger than a planet. It's an entire galaxy that's an ecosystem, and there needs to be a galactic expert that can take care of all that. But the galaxy is disintegrating. We can't, you know, let it just go.
But well, then inevitably, I'm sure that you well, you must be in a position rather like Alexander Dumas the Younger. That ultimately, in 100 years, everybody will be confusing your work and your father's.
I doubt that.
Did you feel any need to distance and?
That's why I wrote two humor books and lots of satires. But then, in the 1990s, I spent 5 years writing that biography of Dad while I was doing other publishing projects. So I was on a path to write a Dune book because I knew too much about it not to.
Well, when you take up a series like that. Where do you develop the sense of where do you want to expand as opposed to where it's too much?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could be controversial and suggest that I think that George Lucas was profoundly mistaken to make the second set of three movies. He should have left that to the imagination.
Right.
Because all he had was a trilogy of things where we already knew how they were going to turn out.
Mm-hmm.
And a story arc that involves a cute kid who grows up to be Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And it just did not work. Mm-hmm. So how do you avoid this problem?
Did it not work because that was the story and you basically had a little kid who was going to grow up to be Hitler, or did it not work just because he didn't do it as well as
really
he should
lousy.
Have?
Right,
I didn't. I would argue that the although it's going to be dark, the concept of this cute little kid who had everything going for him, whose life goes so tragically wrong that he ends up being the most hated man in the universe, Darth Vader, or Paul Atreides, depending on which person you're reading the book from, I would say that that can be an incredibly compelling story. And one of the books that I published a year ago was called The Last Days of Krypton. It's the story of how the whole story of Superman's planet and how it comes to its end. The planet blows up at the end and one little baby gets out, but that doesn't mean that there's no story that you can tell that's interesting. And what we did with the House books was telling the immediate prequels, the love story of Duke Leto and Lady Jessica, the first battles with the bear and the planetologist being sent to Dune. And I think that there, when you have an immense universe that people care about and that they have characters that they love and they want to revisit, we didn't need to have a Romulan ship and Spock coming back in time to reset the timeline to make it interesting. I think we wanted to go, although I loved that movie, but I wanted to just go back and see young Kirk and Spock. I didn't need to have any reason to go back.
We actually can see an end to the series as far as the major novels go, but we're right now staying exactly on the Frank Herbert timeline. So, for example, the House series, we found a chapter that Dad had written that he didn't include in Dune. It would be backstory about when Duke Leto and Lady Jessica met. Well, Kevin and I found that deleted scene chapter. We put it into House Harkonnen. So there we have really stayed on course on Dad's story. And we may have two more. We have two more under contract, and then we have three more after that. And all of them either go back to the history of the founding of the great schools, or other stories that Frank Herbert laid out either in his notes or in his appendices, or just comments that he made. For example, in one of his sequels, he said that Holtzman, a man, was not the one who invented the full space engine. Instead, it was a woman, Norma Senva. So since we knew that there were strong female characters in the series, in the Butlerian Jihad series, we developed Norma Senva as a founder of the Spacing Guild and all that. So, Lady Jessica, by the way, is modeled after my mother, Beverly Herbert. So the strong female characters that you see in the series, there's a lot of expansion we can do there, and it's exactly what Frank Herbert wanted.
At what point do you feel free to invent rather than follow his notes?
Well, he had an appendix describing in outline form the Butlerian Jihad, and he said that Abelard Harkonnen had been a coward 10,000 years before. So I thought that was interesting. But what we did is we went back to that period, and all we had was a name like that, a couple of other names, and then we added all the other framework. But that was a time when Dad said that thinking machines had ruled humans and we rose up in this great jihad. Well, Frank Herbert had been a reporter, and he was flipping over the myth that smiling robots are going to make our lives easier and save time. So I don't think we're inventing things. We're really explaining. And really, Dad spent 20 years trying to explain why Paul Atreides went dark in Dune Messiah. We did it in a novel, Paul of Dune.
So Frank Herbert sort of gave us a roadmap, but we're actually doing the cross-country road trip. And
right.
So we're seeing, we can stop and see little things along the way and explore little side roads, but we know the main structure of the mm-hmm. road system.
But he's basically stretch, but always there as the third collaborator.
Absolutely. And
he put his
hear
him on the road to Dune because he had done so much.
I hear his voice when I'm writing.
Well, basically, you said you see an end.
Mm-hmm.
Well, are you going to stop, or are you going to go out in other directions after that? I mean, you've got a whole galaxy full of people and all of these minor characters.
Right.
It could go on indefinitely.
But it won't. At least not on the big door stopper novels like Kevin and I write. Our next book after this one will be in 2 years. We're alternating years now. It'll be The Throne of Dune, where Shaddam Carino comes back and tries to retake the throne. And after that will be Leto of Dune, or maybe The Golden Path of Dune. It'll be the first years of the God Emperor. And after that, maybe three novels about the founding of the great schools thousands of years before Dune. That'd be The Sisterhood of Dune, The Mentats, and The Sword Masters. And beyond that, there are other stories, but we don't see them as major novels. Maybe some graphic novels that aren't dumbed down. You know, we have to keep up the intellectual level of the series.
Well, that's kind of the real answer, that every one of these books that we do, while our name's on the cover, but the biggest word on the cover is Dune, and there's a certain brand identity that people expect something when it says Dune on the cover, and we don't want to do like the paper clips of Dune or just little quick. It shouldn't be a little off the cuff adventure or a small book. It needs to be have the gravitas that a Dune book has. And if we can't come up with stories that have that much to them, then it doesn't belong in there.
Yeah, you don't want to turn out the soap opera version, which would be called As the Worm Turns.
Yeah. Well,
or the musical comedy with dancing sandworms. I think you're
dancing sandworms.
Yeah. It's a whole species of jokes like this. You know, you've heard about the horror version Charnel House Dune.
Well, how about Gunga Dune?
Gunga Dune. Yeah.
But are we Dune yet?
Yeah. We just want to make sure that we don't water down Dune.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay,
because that would destroy the ecosystem. Yeah.
Yes, it would. You know, at this point, I think we've gotten silly enough. I think maybe we should ask for questions from the audience.
Yeah.
This really is just water. I don't know what's the...
You may be wondering why... It
tastes like Fremen.
You notice that Kevin is looking all dapper in his coat, and I'm not going to explain my misadventures, but I barely got here. I was eating a sandwich in the car and trying not to spill it all over myself as we rushed to get here, so...
But the show must go on, and
absolutely.
I'm amazed and proud that he got here on time.
I was going to walk in late because I knew there'd be tough questions, and I was worried about the interview.
The way this is going to work is that I'm going to point to somebody, and then this lady over here is going to hand you a mic. And there's another microphone person over here. So we'll start with this person here, front row.
I remember reading that Frank was a lay psychoanalyst.
Mm-hmm.
Towards the end of the sixth book. You said he was writing the seventh?
He had just started to make notes on it that I didn't know existed. I saw him using a yellow highlighter, and it turned out 11 years later there were notes.
Towards the end of the series, when Duncan Idaho, not the real one, but the Gola, has a quasi-fight with a reverend mother, and then I'll skip ahead to where they're taking off, and there are all these pictures, American Gothic, a variety of other masterpieces, and then you have the pregnant. Did he explain in any of the notes where he was headed with that? Was he going to go into the Reverend Mothers more, or
well, his notes, as it turned out, the estate of Frank Herbert was still open in 1997. Even though he died in 86, and my mom had died in 84, her estate was still open. It was very complicated. And a state attorney named Walt Tabler called me and said there were two safety deposit boxes, so what did I want to do with them? Well, I'd been an insurance agent for years, and I told my dad always to keep a copy of important manuscripts and things off premises in case there's a fire. Well, I didn't know he did it. And so we went down there, and a state attorney named Jan Cunningham had a yellow legal pad, started writing everything down. We had to break into the boxes legally. Had no keys. We found country and western lyrics. Dad had written some songs. That would be good, huh? And then we found some recipes, some letters, and a Tandy Radio Shack discs, floppy discs that said Dune 7 Notes. And for the naysayers, I actually published that or put that up on our website once. But I actually had an NSA security guy check to make sure there was no other stuff on there other than what we found with it, which was a 30-page printout, 35 pages. And it was the arc of the story, of the plot. And it was character analyses and various focal points of what he thought were important. And so that's what we wrote. But Kevin and I had written The Butler and Jihad, we'd written the House series. And so what Frank Herbert envisioned as one novel, Kevin and I couldn't do it in one novel, so we did it in two novels, Hunters of Dune and Sandworms of Dune.
So that's what answers all of those chapter house questions. It picks up right after that. And, right. And if you notice in the later books that Frank Herbert wrote, when you read Dune, it's this big adventure story, and he's got all kinds of great things in it, but it also has all these other layers. But as he got on to other books, he got more interested in other things. The, the later books are a little more didactic. They're more dense and political. And Frank wanted to talk about these issues that was that were interesting to him. And so he would just fast forward past a lot of the action. In fact, in Heretics of Dune, when the Honored Matres wipe out the planet Dune, they turn it into a charred ball, he does that between chapters. He doesn't even show it. It's the ships are closing in, and they're firing, powering up their weapons. And then the next chapter, there's a couple people sitting around in a garden talking about how much a shame it is that Dune's destroyed. So when Brian and I started writing his outline of Dune 7, well, we like to blow up planets and destroy things like that. So we wanted to flesh out and show all of the action that Frank Herbert often just alluded to, because he wanted to speed ahead and get to the next concept he wanted to talk about.
It was sort of like jumping from Dune to Dune Messiah, and in the meantime, hundreds of billions of people are killed, that he starts Dune Messiah off by saying it happened.
But we like the gaps because they give us novels to write.
Yeah.
Somebody else?
Can you speak a little bit about your collaboration and how you write?
To sell the first three books, the House series, Kevin and I talked for 4 months, and then he flew to Seattle, and we brainstormed in May of '97, and we produced a 140-page book proposal. And normally when you sell a proposal, you can have like 8 pages and maybe a chapter, two or three, that you send into the publisher. So we sent in like this huge thing because we had so much energy surrounding the project. So we come up with very big proposals for each of the trilogies that we put together or other sets of books. And then once we've sold the project to a publisher, Kevin and I will brainstorm again and we'll divide it up into, say, 100 chapters. Kevin will take 50 based on his strengths, and I'll take 50 based on mine. He has a physics degree. He worked at Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore. I'm a sociology guy from Cal Berkeley, so I'll do the philosophy, the sociology, the Bene Gesserit type things. I'll add philosophy. Then we start rewriting each other's chapters. So Kevin, for example, would send me all his 50, and I'll go through all 100 chapters and start adding philosophy to his action, that kind of thing. And then he'll do the reverse when he gets it on the next draft, and it goes through about 10 drafts.
But so, we do it all on the computer, so we I never see what he's marked and changed in my chapters, and he never sees what I mark, because that's what a collaboration's all about. You check the ego at the door, and I trust whatever he's going to do to my prose, and he trusts whatever I'm going to do, and it just keeps going back and forth and back and forth until what emerges in book form has been gone over, so it's got a unified voice that's, we think, better than either of us could have done individually.
But Kevin and I have collaborated before, and I collaborated with my cousin Marie Landis to write a couple of horror novels, and she and I just wrote odd and even chapters. I mean, it wasn't the best way to do it, but it turned out great. I mean, we really had a lot of fun. But with Dad, he was so busy that I came up, and I collaborated on the last novel that Frank Herbert wrote called Man of Two Worlds. I gave him the book proposal as a very serious novel, and I'd written a lot of satires before that. And then Dad was so busy that I spent 13 months writing the entire first draft. And then Dad took it for 6 or 7 months and added a lot of the humor to it. So people think that humor is mine, but it isn't. It was actually Dad's. But the situation was different with Frank Herbert. He's so busy that we had to just block out some time for him to work on it. But with Kevin and me, I think we have the ideal way to do it.
Well, and it depends on how your partnership works. I mean, we've done something that this works for Brian and myself. And there are a lot, especially in science fiction, that there's a lot more collaborations than you would normally see in a, I don't know, mystery or historical novels. But science fiction, a lot of writers like to hang out, exchange ideas, and brainstorm and see what comes out.
Well, Niven and Pornell have done very well with awards, too.
Are you the kind of guys who can actually talk about it at great length before you start writing, or if you talk about it at great length before you start writing, do you lose it? There seem to be two schools of thought on this.
We're definitely in the same school of thought, that we're, especially because we're collaborating, and these are very complex and intricate books. I mean, each one of them has six or seven main storylines and main characters going back and forth that we feel if we just started off without really working it out together, it would be like trying to build a grand skyscraper without bothering to do a blueprint first. That we really want to map it out in great detail to know, so I know what he's doing in his chapter, he knows what I'm doing in my chapter. But in no way does that stifle the creativity, because we spent days doing the creative stuff and drawing up the blueprint. That we feel that the designing the architecture is the creative part, not putting the bricks down.
But Dad and I would talk and talk about it without taking notes. And I know he did that with Bill Ransom, too, on the collaboration he did with Bill. And at some point, somebody says, we better get this written down before we forget it.
I find that it really energizes me to be brainstorming with Brian. It doesn't make me tired of the project at all. It makes me all fired up, because I'll come up with this really good idea, and then he'll give something that makes it take a left turn, and it becomes a really great idea, and that's how you just add to each other, and it really gets better.
Okay. That's the question over here. In the blue shirt.
I wonder if you could tell me about the linguistic aspects of your dad's work. I was introduced to it on a rainy weekend in Cape Cod, never having heard of the Dune series, and I couldn't put it down. And one of the things I remember very sharply is the linguistic originalities, or borrowings, as the case may be.
Yeah, there's a poetic beauty to the words that he chose. Sihaya, desert stream, and just some beautiful words. But he combined, he based a lot of it on Arabic, at least the Fremen language. But then he would add Navajo and languages from the Gobi Desert, and he just was able to really absorb a lot of information. He did speak Latin and Spanish, and he just made up a lot of things. He liked to combine words, combine languages, combine concepts. He said that in the future, I was writing a story one time, and he said, you can have a character named Ichiro Munoz. So he's got a Japanese first name and a Mexican last name. You don't have to explain it. It's just sort of detritus from the past, is the way Dad put it. And you look at the religions that he created, Zen Sufi, a combination there, the Orange Catholic, that's the Protestants and the Catholics and others, a Buddhist Islamic. So he just was, he wasn't sticking to any one language. He was making things up. But there are actually some real words in there, too, as certain experts have pointed out to me. Some real Navajo words, for example. And Dad believed the Native American view of the universe was the better, as opposed to the way we live. And so, for example, the character he identified with most was Stilgar, the leader of the Fremen. And Dad's very best friend in the world was a Native American. And so, by the way, that Native American said, and I'm going to go to a little bit different subject, but Howie was his name, and he was a Norwegian. A Norwegian family had adopted him, and he was a full-blooded Native American. And Howie said, the Frank Herbert that you know would not have existed had it not been for Beverly Herbert. So he was there. The Native American best friend was there when Dad met my mother at the University of Washington in 1946. So that's a little off the question you asked, but that's how it is with answers about Frank Herbert.
Right. let me throw something back at you so that you can. Yeah. He's talking about the linguistics of Dune. Mm-hmm. Didn't you once tell me that Dune itself, he first started writing it as a haiku?
It was a haiku, 17 syllables, most of the haikus that I've seen are about nature, these Japanese poems. And so, the original haiku has not survived, but it was taped to his desk for a while. I have the desk, and I've looked all over it for it. I can't find it.
That may be the most expanded haiku in the history of literature.
Absolutely, yeah.
Especially if you count all the 17 volumes of the Dune books.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Next to that, The Lord of the Rings as a limerick is expensive.
But actually, you can read Dune for the poetry, and then you can go back and read the philosophy, the politics, the religion. You can read any of these layers, or you can just read the adventure story.
Somebody else. Men on the end here.
Thank you. Do you think we'll ever see another theatrical release of a film in the Dune universe? And if so, who would you want to helm it?
I usually answer that question, but I think Kevin knows the answer.
Well, funny you should ask. actually, I mean, you've all are aware of the David Lynch movie in 1984, and then the Sci-Fi Channel did two six-hour miniseries. They each had their own advantages and disadvantages, but Paramount has now acquired the rights to do a big budget, big screen. I hesitate to use the word remake of
it's
the original Dune.
Classic interpretation.
Right.
This is why I answer the question, not him. Because we've been told what we can say carefully. It's true.
Instead of a remake, we want it to be done correctly in the first place. And thanks to Peter Jackson, who proved that with Lord of the Rings, that you really can do that big of a movie, that big of a book, and do it successfully. Mm-hmm. Right now, Peter Berg has signed on to be the director. He did Hancock and Friday Night Lights and The Kingdom. Mm-hmm. And we've got some big-name producers on it. And we've met with the team, and we're sort of involved in some of the creative stuff. But right now, it's still in the script-writing phase. And it's Hollywood, so don't hold your breath, but it's sort of moving along.
And Peter Jackson raised the stakes, so it has to be a good movie. You can't get everything in Dune into that movie, though, so that's the challenge. But we do have Richard Rubenstein as one of the producers, and he did the two television series where he followed the plot very faithfully. So we have a good team.
Right here.
A little background on that. I'm sure not pronouncing it correctly. The Bene Gesserit?
Yeah, Dad said they're like female Jesuits. So you're right, Bene Gesserit.
That is. Mm-hmm. Do you have any more information on how that concept came to be?
Right. My dad had, I think it was 11 Irish Catholic aunts, and they tried to force Catholicism on him, and Dad rebelled. My mom similarly didn't have all those aunts, but they tried to force Pentecostalism on her. So I had no religion, organized religion, when I was growing up. Ultimately, Dad was a non-practicing Buddhist, as it turns out. But the Bene Gesserit came from his Irish Catholic aunts that had, he saw them as kind of a cluster of women that had this power about them, and he somehow resisted it. But he also, as Daryl mentioned, my dad was a lay psychologist. Well, that was in the early 1950s, late 40s, when we lived in Santa Rosa, California. And at that time, good friends of our family were the Slatteries, and they had been he was a professor at Sonoma State, and she was a well-known psychologist who had studied with Carl Gustav Jung in the 1930s. And she had notes that she brought to Dad and talked to him about. And Jung had the concept of the collective unconscious. And so the Bene Gesserit, with their memory, their genetic memory going back for thousands of years, and the voices that emerge from within to guide that particular living sister, is based upon Jung. And then the strong women. My mother was an incredibly strong woman, and Dad felt we needed more female energy in the universe, because men have pretty well messed things up for about 10,000 years. But I think before that, some of the goddess things were kind of, unbalanced too. So Dad wanted the pendulum to swing. So by books 5 and 6 in the series, women are running everything. As they should.
Here in the middle.
Hi, thanks. I have a two-part question. You had mentioned how your mother played, a strong source of inspiration for sort of the female characters in the story. With his books, but also with your books, is there anyone in your life that has sort of been a source of inspiration, or for you, Kevin, that has sort of like worked its way into the framework of the stories? And also, Daryl Schweitzer, will you be available afterwards?
Yeah.
Just to talk.
Okay. Well, we've dedicated this novel to our wives, and it's largely, we phrase it in such a way that, we appreciate what they've had to put up with when Kevin and I vanish. And Dad was like that too. He would just vanish up into his study. My mom would would wait. She was a very brilliant person, but she would wait for him to come down out of his science fiction universe, and then they could go do something. But one of my early novels, Sudana, Sudana, I have this futuristic world that's all covered with goo, and there's these ships floating across through the goo and things. And one of the leading character, this is just an anecdote, but the leading character has problems with his wife because she keeps pulling the covers off, you know. And that's my wife, Jan. But and I had a rebellious daughter at the time, and there is a rebellious daughter in that story. But you know, Kevin and I both have very supporting wives and very intelligent wives that give us different ways of thinking. And when we write a female character wrong, they'll let us know.
Very clearly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been, my wife, Rebecca Mesta, and I have written over 30 novels together, and we're still married, which is kind of an amazing thing. We do have a guest bedroom that sometimes I've had to go through after brainstorming, but we've been married 18 years, and even when she's not collaborating with me, she brainstorms with me all the time and reads the whole manuscript, and then she gives me the really, really tough copy editing of the manuscript that copy editors are too scared to do. I mean, she'll take a page and she'll just do this and write boring on it. And I haven't yet gotten that from a New York copy editor, which is good, I suppose. But she makes me be a much better writer. And I know, see, I think it's impressive. I've been married for 18 years, but that's nothing. He's 42
years.
Years.
I met her when she was very young, and I was very young. But one time it's not so much whispering, you are mortal, because we know we're not pharaohs or anything. But one time I was talking to an audience like this, and I was talking about the female characters that I have in my other books, and I felt like I was becoming something of a women's liberationist, and I heard my wife out there snickering in the audience, so, you know, and deservedly so, you know, because I didn't know anything.
Okay, I see a question way back there, that lady in the back.
First of all, guys, being a writer, you guys intimidate me whenever I read because it's such great writing craft. But being a Norwegian myself, I don't have the Native American sort of knowledge background. I see Rachel Carson coming through very strongly.
That's true.
The
Silent
right
Spring.
Now. Yeah. Could you guys talk a little bit more about this? The environmental influence here?
Right. Obviously, Rachel Carson's great book had been published before Dune, and so Dad was aware of it. But, you know, Dad was, he said to me, he had a lot of messages. If you look at Dune, I mean, the Whole Earth Catalog referred to it as an ecological masterpiece, our handbook. And but that's just one of the messages, and that is the message that really catapulted Dune. It took 5 years to 1970. Book was published in 65. By 1970, there was a groundswell because of the environmental issue. And Frank Herbert spoke at the first Earth Day in Philadelphia. And Ira Einhorn organized that, by the way. He's got a kind of a star-crossed history there. And then Dad spoke on college campuses all over the United States just on that environmental issue. But there's so many other things in there. There's the politics and the religion and all these other incredible things. But Dad set up a detailed ecosystem. So, for example, at the end of the first movie about Dune, it rains at the end. Well, that can't happen on Dune, or it would destroy the cycle of the sandworms. And Frank Herbert explained that very carefully. So he understood from when he was growing up as a 9-year-old boy. He would go out. My grandparents were alcoholics. They spent all the money they had on booze. And so Dad went out fishing and brought in the dinner for the day. And in the process, he met a Native American who had been an outcast. This is on Fox Island near Tacoma, Washington. And Dad said the outcast had been a murderer in his tribe, and they sent him out there to the island. Well, Dad kind of embellished some things sometimes. I don't know if he was really a murderer, but it made a good story. So there's this 9-year-old kid out there adventuring, and this Native American taught Dad how to live in the woods, you know, how to eat grub worms and red ants and how to fish, and just totally another world view. Dad would sometimes take his 9-foot rowboat out and he would hitch it on to tugboats that were pulling barges heading for Alaska until he got caught and they'd cut him loose. So he was always out there in the environment, you know, and that really comes through. I mean, some people read Dune and they get thirsty. Well, Dad never lived in the desert, but he certainly figured out how to write about it.
Well, and it's certainly there's a background in it from where I come from. I live in Colorado, and I spend most of my time when I get free time out hiking or mountain climbing. I have climbed to the top of all 54 of the 14,000-foot peaks in the state of Colorado. I've done 320 miles on the Colorado Trail, and for years I've been a member of a Sierra Club and the Nature Conservancy and Colorado Trail Foundation, the Continental Divide, I mean, all these different things. And my whole background is any chance that I get, I want to be out and I do my writing with the tape recorder. So I'm out in the mountains, in the forest, and that's where I'm dictating things. In fact, I've written a lot of dune stuff in the Great Sand Dunes National Park in Colorado or in Death Valley in California. And my wife and I donate quite a lot of money to various charitable organizations, and it's always a tug of war between the two of us because she wants to donate all kinds of money to soup kitchens and feed the orphans and save the children and all that. And I want to spend money on the Sierra Club and the Colorado Trail, and she tells me that's being kind of cold-hearted because it's not helping people. And I'm thinking, well, it's helping the whole world and the environment. So we have those are the nights I sleep in the guest bedroom sometimes.
But, you know, the Sierra Club comment is interesting because Dad was a Republican speechwriter in the 1950s. And I think I mentioned that he was also a non-practicing Buddhist. But he was an anti-war leader in Seattle. And war is the biggest destroyer of the environment that there is. He was in the World Without War Council. And so here's this big bearded Republican leading thousands of students up in Seattle taking over the freeways. But Dad felt that the Sierra Club had gone too far. They'd been too extreme. And what Dad said is that they were so radical, and this is back in the 60s, maybe early 70s, that a bunch of loggers just went in and clear-cut a whole huge areas because they were afraid of what would happen when the Sierra Club, you know, got their rules in. So Dad was a pragmatist, and he believed in negotiating these things from a reasonable standpoint.
I think one of the things that makes your collaboration so great is the adherence to the original. When we read one of your books, it's almost the same as reading the original by Frank Herbert.
Thank you.
It sticks so much to the theme and the feeling. And that doesn't work with other writers. And I'm thinking of Orphra Clark and Gentry Lee, where if you read any of their collaborations, you can almost tell word for word what Clark wrote and what Lee wrote.
Right. Well, as Kevin mentioned, we set our egos aside at the door, but we also have the same vision. If any of you have gone to Europe, for example, and one of you wants to shop and the other wants to see the history, it doesn't work. Well, Kevin and I are on this huge journey through the Dune universe, and we have the same vision. And sometimes he'll come up with an idea that's the same idea that I've had, and he was just going to, and I've already had the idea, but I got my facts on his desk before he was able to fax me. So on the last one, I beat him to it. But we're coming up with the same ideas in parallel. So and we don't try to outshine each other. We've talked about shining a light on each other, but ultimately we're shining a light on Frank Herbert, and that's really what it's about, is going back and reading Dune again.
Well, and somebody asked us a couple of days ago on a book signing that, did you write this part or did Brian write this part? And we looked at each other, and we can't even remember who wrote which part because we rewrite each other's parts so much. Mm-hmm. But as far as the adherence to Frank Herbert's stuff, we really need to please the toughest Dune fans. And I think we're the toughest Dune fans. Both Brian and I are just, we live and breathe everything about Dune. We have immersed ourselves in these books and in the notes that Frank Herbert left and in our own stories. So we're not just like picking up an hors d'oeuvre. We're there for the whole banquet, and we try to make that come across.
We also, before I wrote A Word with Kevin, I spent a year doing a concordance of all six of Frank Herbert's Dune novels. So I know all the page references for the history of the sisterhood and everything, the eye colors of all the characters, all the details, and so we refer to that all the time.
Here. One more after that.
You refer to the Bene Gesserits as the women, you know, you were saying they're strong characters, but yet you have them with a computer.
Well, that's a secret breeding records that they have.
That's a secret.
Well, no. That,
but in a way, you're undermining, I'm not saying you're, you know, fat or anything, but I mean, they still have a computer, which is something they're not supposed to have.
Well, but it's secret. See, by the time of Dune, computers are illegal because of what they did to us 10,000 years before. And so in the novel Dune, we don't know that yet. But the Bene Gesserit are, and it's like Paul Atreides. You think he's a heroic figure by the end of Dune, and it turns out that there's a dark side to him. Well, there is a dark side to the Bene Gesserit, too. As you just take a look at the Honored Matres, which are the dark side of the Bene Gesserit, and they're coming back and destroying our heroines and Dune. They destroyed the planet Dune. So Dad was not naive enough to think that heroes or heroines would be pure.
And they're also very pragmatic, and they have their end goal in sight, and they're willing to bend some of their own rules to achieve it. So.
But, you know, the Bene Gesserit, though, ultimately, many times they're talking about what it means to be human. And that's an important theme to Frank Herbert. You'll see that not only in the Dune series, but in his other books. And really, so since there are no computers, for example, in the time of Dune, what do you have? You have mentats, which are like Frank Herbert characters all over the place with these computerized brains. And he's talking about human potential. And look at the potential for women and for other things. And that's why the series has really lasted, as opposed to other big series, 19, 20 book series, that were hinging upon technology. This is not hinging on any aspect of technology or science. It's about people.
One more. Okay.
Yes, I wanted to just ask something in expanding on what this gentleman over here had to say. When you talk about how hard you work to follow Frank Herbert's whole universe, you do more than that. You know, I've read all of your father's works, and I've read all of your works, and your both works, and it's hard to tell the difference between Frank Herbert and your writing. And how in the world did you accomplish that? How did you come up with that ability to write in that style? And I mean, okay, fine, they're different. You created these books, and you had the barest framework to begin with. But you've perfected a style that just blends so well into the Dune that it's just, it's almost, did you work at that? Or did
no,
it just come about?
Partly it's admiration for Frank Herbert, but Dad believed in the oral tradition and stories being told and passed on from generation to generation. And I heard him reading all the Dune novels to my mother. So somewhere in my subconscious, I hear his voice reading to her. I hear his voice speaking to me. And plus the details of what he taught me about writing. He taught me the care and feeding of editors, how to build suspense. He had the care and feeding of editors. It was kind of amusing, as how to send a manuscript in and it won't get thrown into the slush pile. But he, for example, in one novel, I sent him my Sidney's Comet novel, my environmental novel, and 300 pages at the time. He edited 20 pages, sent them back, and he said, this is how editing tightens the story. He mailed it back to me from Hawaii. And he said, go now and do likewise. So he was telling me from the beginning that the hard work, I had to do it. But I appreciate that comment. Our style, I mean, Frank Herbert changed his style. If you look at, as Kevin mentioned, you know, Dune is one style. It's got this beautiful poetry and this great adventure, and beneath it are all these messages. But later, by the time you get to God Emperor of Dune and on, the characters are talking a lot about politics and big things happen in the background. So he changed his style too, but he was exploring the layers he'd already set up in the novel Dune. Our style, we like to really look at Dune as an example, but I don't think Kevin or I ever hope to match that.
Well, and yeah. When we started out, we even discussed this, but we mm-hmm. intentionally said we are not going to try to imitate Frank mm-hmm. Herbert's style because he's got a distinctive style. And we were both well-established as professional writers before we started even writing together or started writing in the Dune universe. So we didn't want to be, like, imitating the way somebody writes. I mean, if somebody's going to write new Conan novels, you don't want them to imitate sentence by sentence the way Robert E. Howard wrote or some of the other things like that. But mm-hmm. perhaps it comes across just because it's so many years of constant exposure and immersion in the Dune universe, because we sort of read the Dune books and turn around and read them all again and read them all again. So it's this constantly in our mind and in our imagination what Frank Herbert wrote. And so when we're doing The Winds of Dune, we both practically memorized Dune Messiah back and forth. So maybe it's just by an osmosis, but we do try to write something that is respectful and in that universe.
And I think we feel like the characters are really alive. And sometimes I have to remind myself, you know, otherwise.
Okay, I think we have just run out of time. And Brian and Kevin will be upstairs in a little bit signing books. So we'll see you all up there.
Thank you, Darrell.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.